construction, golf news, equipment, travel, interviews, course profiles, and more. Your weekly fix of all things golf is about to begin. It's the Flagstick Podcast with your hosts, Jeff Bonner and Scott McLeod. Hello, friends. Welcome to the Flagstick Podcast. Sorry. Yes, welcome to the Flagstick Podcast, friends. Brought to you this week by Golf PEI. Golf Prince Edward Island, premier Canadian golf destination, boasting the most number of golf courses per capita in this great country. With over 400 fairways, closer than you can imagine, top-tiered accommodations, and exquisite culinary experiences, it is the easiest golf vacation you will ever book. Book your vacation at golfpei.ca. Check us out on the social media networks, Instagram, X, TikTok, and Facebook, and subscribe on Spotify, Audible, and Apple Podcasts. We really do encourage you to subscribe on YouTube, like us, and click the notification bell. Make sure you never miss a single episode, because who knows what the heck we're going to put up there.
Oh, there's lots coming.
There is indeed. Some really cool stuff coming, actually. Yeah. Anyway, I'm Jeff Botter. This guy here is Scott McLeod.
And, oh, it's not Jim Nance? I thought I was on with Jim Nance.
Hello, friends. This is Jim Nance.
Yeah, well.
Welcome to the muck and rain. Masters 2024. and with that, we'll start there. It's funny because on the TV screen beside me, I got Duthie and Bob Weeks and
Scully on the panel there?
No.
I don't have it on TV. Oh, Graham. Yeah.
Sorry. The mustache man.
Beard.
It is a cool mustache, too. But I'm distracted because I'm trying to do this and they're over there. And
yeah, well, there's no play happening yet. So there's not much.
No, but it still looks nice out there, even though it's gloomy, ugly. And I'm sure it's going to be one very, very wet day. I mean, it'll dry out pretty quickly with the wind that they have going on there. And, you know, they've got the greens will dry out quickly because they've got the subterranean sub-air system to pull some of that moisture out of the green. So it is Augusta National. There are not that many golf courses in the world that have this particular system in place, but there's not too many golf courses in the world that are Augusta National.
So we are obviously recording this just as about to play is about to get underway. So just to, timestamp it, I guess more than anything, honorary starters are expected right now at 10:10 and first tee shot going to be 10:30.
I didn't get the call. I thought I'd get the call this year.
Just got the pin sheets. I just got the hole locations. They look very yummy. Interesting. Very tasty. Interesting. So yeah, keep an eye on holes like 11 front left, number 4, back right, really tight to the side, and a new hole location on 2, which is kind of in the center towards the back. So those will be fun ones. So they've got some things they're playing around with. So yeah, it's good. I'm stoked. I mean, it's hard to ignore talking about the Masters. So I mean, we'll still obviously interweave some Masters.
Is it a big deal this week? Is this a big tournament?
Apparently, a few people pay attention to it.
I've heard that a lot of people do pay attention. It's kind of one of these major things.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Major things. All right. Well. We want to talk more Masters, but before we just go start getting too deep into the show, let's just kind of line it all up a little bit and then jump and get into our front nine. Obviously, we're going to... shush.
No jumping.
We're going to catch up with some of the some local latest news, some hot topics. A lot of things have happened or are going on right now. So we're going to get you caught up. We're going to catch you up. And that'll be on the front nine and the back nine. Obviously, we are going to talk a little bit more Masters, but particularly we're going to talk about the essential skills that one might need to conquer Augusta National. And how you can work on those skills yourself. So we're going to get into that in the back nine, but let's get to the front nine presented by Metcalf Golf Club. A natural setting, a pleasant challenge. Golf season is here. So now you have to start preparing for the upcoming season. Get on the wait list for memberships and leagues or purchase some game passes to start the season. Save big time compared to regular green fees. Visit MetcalfGolf.com to shop for those now. Season is here.
Yeah, and actually
everything's just, pretty much like this is it. I know the aforementioned Metcalf opening on Monday for members, just, Tuesday for the public.
Yeah, just added it to the calendar.
As a member, I knew that.
As a media member, I knew that because Rob emailed me.
Shut up. Shut up. You did not. You did not.
Added a lot to the calendar in the last couple days, that's for sure. Thanks again to the a lot of the GMs, a bunch of the pros, committee members, so forth, board members for reaching
for making
out.
This golf opening calendar possible.
Well, I won't go that far, but at least for contributing and sending stuff in, obviously it's helpful for sure.
We would say that it's getting to the point now where probably within the next couple of weeks, the calendar will be coming down.
Yeah, I mean,
well, it'll be there, but everything will be pretty much open, so there won't be any surprises.
I think when we see facilities like Lockmarch, I think they're the 22nd. We don't have confirmed dates in from ClubLink yet for their facilities. Usually those are the ones that open a little bit later. Upper Canada, which is usually one that's a kind of a later opening, although they had a quick announcement yesterday that Lawrence Buhaus, who used to be at Brockville back in the day, superintendent, is their new superintendent Upper Canada, but they tend to be one that's a little bit later, run by the Parks Commission. But as you said, probably a couple weeks, May 1st, we'll probably have most of them there. The calendar will obviously be of less importance at that point.
Correct. You are correct. All right. So let's talk, just get a little bit of the Masters stuff out of the way now. Wait, you know what? Do we want to do the Masters now? Do we want to talk about this little preamp to the Masters, or do I want to hold that back and do that?
We hold back.
There's nothing we could talk about that in the background. It's not timely or anything. Instead, let's talk about the President's Cup.
Sure.
Which is geographically timely.
Yes, very much. Yes. And timely in the fact that they had their official news, which we did talk about on here already, because we had the some of the details already, but
tickets. Now is the time.
Today. On sale starting today to the public.
I gotta think
10 a.m.
that tickets are going to sell quickly.
Yeah.
I gotta think. This is a big one. I mean, the President's Cup in the past has been big, even when it was at Royal Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, Mike Weir was the only Canadian even remotely close to being on that team, and was on that team. But there were really no other Canadians that were really
Dillette came soon after that. But yeah, at that point in 2007, certainly. Yeah.
So there was some excitement about having a Canadian in the President's Cup when it was in Canada. But this go round potentially could be three or four.
Potentially.
But there'd definitely be more than one.
Well, we at least have a captain to start with. So obviously that makes a difference. And yeah, I would expect minimum two, as many as four.
You imagine?
I mean, I think the excitement is there. I mean, already in talking to Ryan Hart, the executive director, I mean, the response already from the corporate side of it had been great as far as how the things were selling. They're expecting that same reaction from the public side, which again, it goes on sale today. And really, when you start to look at it, they've opened it up a little bit earlier in the week, the Tuesday, Wednesday, the practice rounds, great value, kind of at $63 a piece. If you can't, you got to remember, there's not as many golfers out there. But here's a really good chance on a quieter day to get out, see the golf course, have that chance to see the players.
A little more up close and personal than when the tournament actually starts, or when the Presidents' Cup actually starts.
Once you get a lot of people in there, those competition rounds The price goes up significantly. You're up to $195.50. That's including taxes and stuff like that. But relative to what you're going to see and for the entertainment value and so forth, it's pretty good. And I know they've got a lot of stuff going on there with extra grandstands. The build is bigger than it has been ever before. But yeah, that's they're rocking. So as of today, yeah, grab your tickets if you want your public tickets. So
Yeah, do it.
yeah.
You won't regret it. You won't
No,
regret it
for
watching
sure.
an event like this. It's a very different experience than going, say, watching the LPGA at the Hunt, or even going up and watching
RBC
the
Canadian Open
RBC
or whatever.
Canadian
Yep.
Open,
Yep.
wherever you would have watched it, if it was up
Sure.
in Toronto at Glen Abbey, or if it was at Hamilton Country Club or wherever,
Yep.
it's a different experience when you've got that many people following essentially three or two or three guys on every hole throughout the course of the day. It's a much smaller group of people you can follow, and it's I found it was easier to follow because of the smaller groups of getting in, jumping ahead holes and waiting for them to come. Seeing your favorites, because there's only at any given time there could be,
Four
eight
groups out
guys,
there, so
four
yeah.
groups out there. So, I mean,
Yeah.
you're gonna get to see the guys you want to see.
Yeah, and I think the other side of it is, one, you're guaranteed stars, right?
100%.
Unlike going to, your average event, there's a lot of groups where maybe they're not as high profile players that are there. These are all high profile players. So you've got that going for you. And then the other side of it is, yeah, I guess that's the biggest thing is the fact that, and everything counts a lot. It's not like you're watching somebody who's, the last person to make the cut and they're just kind of mailing it in to kind of get their check and, they know they're not competing. Every match here is going to be somewhat competitive. There's going to be some where maybe there's a blowout or something like that. But so you've got stars, you've got players that are caring about kind of what's going to happen here. And, frankly, it's a great venue for it. Well, especially when you get down to the later holes. If any of the matches get to at least, kind of 14, there's a lot of stuff going on at that golf course. So yeah, so grab your tickets now. They also have Captain's Club tickets if you want an experience that's a little higher priced as far as but has a little bit more comfort. You're not just walking around, you got a place to sit and so forth. So a lot of that stuff's available as well, and you can just go to their website and check it out.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the OVGA, because it is the time of the year we're starting to, as the courses start to open, the OVGA tournament schedule has come out. The OVGA, by the way, the Ottawa Valley Golf Association, for those that don't know, now you do. Consider yourself informed and educated. They hosted their annual general meeting, which always precedes the season, and generally that's when the club captains and for the most part get together at a location. This is done by Zoom, during the COVID years, I guess. It's
Was
still
that
available on
Highlands this
Zoom
year?
because you zoomed it.
Sick as a dog. I
Yeah,
zoomed in for a
so it
couple
was good. It
hours.
was good that it was being zoomed. But they had their annual general meeting. Generally, the annual general meeting, a lot of sort of things are discussed with respect to, the events that are coming up, the format of the events, getting announcing the board, the
Yeah, it's
new
really
the
summarizing the
yeah
season past more than anything, and then kind of
introducing the season to come.
yeah, pretty much. So, it's never a case of having a lot of different things that are maybe, controversial or whatever. There's no usually not a lot of big decisions made. Occasionally there's some things that are brought forward. I mean, you have to consider a lot of times, the board's is working kind of, daily, kind of doing things, working behind the scenes. And this is the chance finally when people are back from down south, people are thinking about golf again, they're thinking about what's ahead, and the chance is here for the for that committee to kind of bring all their efforts forward and for approval and stuff like that. So what stand out? I put a couple of notes in there.
And I'll say right off the bat, as we're talking about volunteers and the board and stuff like that, that there are some volunteers that are needed.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of use this platform right now just to kind of, you know, make people aware that the OVGA is in search of a women's tournament director, somebody who would meet with the tournament committee for three or four times a year, coordinate 4 to 6 events each season, kind of the one that runs the show, kind of what we do with the Flagstick Open. You're kind of running the show leading into and during the event. They're also looking for some tournament coordinators, which is a little bit more the on-site people that they'll select the events that they want to run, oversee the running of those selected tournaments, and work closely with the tournament director, you know, to ensure that those events are as successful as they possibly can be. So if you're interested at all in getting involved in tournament operations, seeing what the OVGA is all about, you know, great opportunity if you don't want to take on the big responsibility of being the tournament director. But getting into doing a tournament coordinator role where you're on site, you get to pick which events you want to be involved in and be on site. It's kind of a cool experience. I will tell you that, you know, obviously from a lot of experience running tournaments, you know, being on site, being there when everybody's registering and getting their scorecards and warming up and seeing them start off the first tee and watching them come in and sign their cards afterwards, it really is kind of a cool experience to be a part of. So something to check out.
And they do have, I didn't include that in the notes, but they have a new program. I think they did it last year as well. They have like an ambassador program where they actually, so if you look at the schedule and you see that one of the events is going to be at your club, they kind of seek out a person that's working, that's at that club. Just makes it easier. Somebody that's familiar with the facility, they get to help out kind of coordinating the tournament and the event. It helps save the OVGA mileage for sending one of their volunteers from, you know, the middle of nowheres. So that's something that's there as well. So, you know, the team is really looking for that. The women's tournament director is super important. There hasn't been one in place for a while. And that's obviously super, super critical as far as helping these events and make them happen. And, you know, they don't just happen, people. You know, people, you know, these organizations need help, and they are volunteer-based organizations. So
you're kidding me. They need help.
Yeah.
The events don't just happen.
No.
Crazy. All right. They also sort of announced at the meeting who what the board was going to look like going into the season. I mean, if we want to say who those people are, you know, Drew Lefebvre is back as the president of the OVGA. Do we want to list them?
Nah, probably not. I mean, we can, I'll end up, I'll throw a post up on flagstick.com.
Okay. All right. Let's do that.
And people can have a look at that as well to know it. And you can obviously refer to the OVGA website as well to go and, you know, get signed up and see kind of what's going on there. So.
Still some things up in the air with respect to our involvement with OVGA events this year. We haven't, Big Jim Davidson and I, who is the junior tournament chair, we haven't had a chance to really sit down and talk about our involvement, though we will be involved somehow, some way in the OVGA, possibly through the intersectional program, which is kind of like my fave. And I do so love the intersectionals, though never played in them.
They're fun.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. Sure they are. Speaking of intersectionals, the Kingston Quinty Kingston intersectional matches are all ready to go.
They are.
For their 17th season.
Already.
I know, it's kind of crazy.
I mean, they reached out. Blair Harris, who does their media coordinating, reached out. He's been great as a liaison for them. You know, just gave us a little bit of a summary. It's all up on flagstick.com if people want to have a look there. But you know, they're up to 80 teams now with from 19 clubs playing in those intersectionals. They're across 6 divisions now. So and they were modeled specifically after Montreal and Ottawa, and that was, you know, back in the day. It was Gilles Hurtubise who was our president of the when we had a regional association that was part of Golf Ontario. He, you know, kind of grew up or came from the Montreal area and, you know, brought the idea there. And, you know, it's gained traction, which has been nice to see. And like we say, it's into 17 years now,
which That's crazy. Is
fantastic. So, I mean, yeah, it seems almost like yesterday that they got started, and I think they're just, you know, again, it's really about the volunteers and the people that are kind of behind it here and making it happen. They're the ones that are really pushing along. And as a result of it, it's making a difference there. So
cool. All right. If you're interested at all in learning more about the Quinty Kinks intersectional matches, you can kind of find, you know, past winners and stuff at flagstick.com. Mm-hmm. Their past champions just going into the season, the women's division champion is Cataraqui, senior women's division champions, Cataraqui, men's A division champion, Trillium Wood, B division, Rivendell, senior men's, Cataraqui, super senior men's, Garrison.
Yeah.
All right. Brockville is hosting a big,
mm-hmm.
big event this year, and they have a volunteer recruitment event scheduled. This is super important, and we always talk about volunteers and the importance that we just talked about with the OVGA, the importance of volunteers. When the opportunity comes for a golf club to host one of these big provincial championships, or you know national championships or regional championships, whatever the case may be,
right,
a lot of volunteers are really needed to make sure that the event, you know, goes off without a hitch, is perfect. And Brockville's is hosting the 89th annual Ontario Senior Men's Championship. Great golf course for this event, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Very challenging golf course. Not super long. Requires precision, which is what our senior men's top senior men in the province are capable of doing. Hitting it a decent distance, they still hit it fairly long, but they're precise. They're mm-hmm. seasoned veterans of the game.
Let's see if they have the patience to deal with some of the greens sometimes, especially if they get them up to speed here. They can be it's the separator at Brockville. We know that for sure.
Well, it's and that's the case with a lot of golf courses, like a course like Brockville, is there's a protection mechanism built in to most golf courses. If it's not length being mm-hmm. the protection mechanism, maybe it's a lot of bunkers to require mm-hmm. you to place your shots off the tee precisely. And in a lot of cases, the protection mechanism for some golf courses is to have fairly difficult greens to complexes to navigate.
Yeah.
navigate Magellan. Okay. So they need between 60 and 75 volunteers each day to address all the things required, whether it's registration, hospitality, getting range balls ready, refreshment stations, four caddies, and all that kind of stuff. So this is really important. Now, they got they've got a recruitment event scheduled to happen on April 27th between 10 a.m. and 12 noon in the lower lounge in Stanley's Lounge, the lower golf lounge. So if you're interested in kind of, you know, the event's happening July 22nd to the 25th. So if you're interested in kind of getting involved in an event like this, it's a cool opportunity. It's fun. Mm-hmm. It's not a major commitment, but it's a bit of one, and you might enjoy yourself. But get down to the recruitment event. I'm sure mm-hmm. that there'll be some snacks or something there for you.
I'm sure. So, again, if people want to go to flagstick.com, we have a post up there with a contact email if you need it. But otherwise, you know, the details are, as you said, we do have another event that's happening. I'll have to reach out as well to the team at Carleton, because we do have the Canadian Mid-Amateur Championship that's happening there. I'm sure they probably have a lot of members that are volunteering for that, but I'll reach out to Tyler there too and see what their situation is and if they need some volunteers there. But, you know, it doesn't hurt if you're more local and you're not maybe down on the Seaway near Brockville, maybe reach out to Carleton and say, hey, you know, I'm looking to volunteer. How can I help out if I can?
There you go. Lastly, with respect to this kind of AGM season, PGA of Ottawa AGM was held at Equinel just this past Monday. And there were about 40 PGA pros in attendance.
Yep.
As is usually the case, the afternoon of the meetings was centered around the education assessments, focused on managing human resources with an expert from Montreal, Melissa Picard.
Yep.
And you know, this is part of what the PGA does, is there is an element to, you know, every year there's an element that is these pros are required, and whether they're required or not, they, you know, insist themselves on ensuring that their knowledge is up to date. And there's a lot of education seminars and stuff that go on, not just at the AGM, but throughout the year, whether they're teaching seminars or what have you, that allow them to stay updated and knowledgeable about the current goings on in the industry. So just so you know, your pro's not just, you know, sitting around all winter watching reruns of Chicago Med
Fire.
And eating Doritos. Okay. they're putting in the work.
Yeah. I would say, even, you know, if I've used myself as an example, I probably did
3 bags of Doritos.
No, I probably did 12 to 14 webinars of some kind over the winter time. So, I mean, you know, that's not uncommon as far as some of the pros. And I mean, it really depends on, you know, what they specialize in and what they're doing. But a lot of them are heading off to conferences, management conferences. Depends what the roles are at their clubs. But certainly, you know, looking at things like retail, all sorts of different things, obviously coaching, teaching. But yeah, I mean, that knowledge has to be updated all the time to really kind of stay ahead. And certainly, as you said, you know, not everybody's just sitting around snacking all winter and watching reruns.
Gotcha. All right. I'm just going to close out our front nine here with a little announcement. Just a reminder that the application is available, open right now for the flagstick.com shootout that will be held at Smuggler's Glen in July.
Yep,
the
flagstick.com shootout presented by Cobra
Puma. I was just going to say that, presented by Cobra Puma Golf. Just that was the second part of the announcement that confirmed that Cobra Puma Golf is has come on board as our full sponsor partner for the flagstick.com shootout. We're very excited about that, you know, that relationship that we have with Cobra Puma and building on that and having them on board as our full sponsor, full title sponsor. Great event, looking to really grow it this year. You know, get the size of the field even a little bit bigger. So if you want to participate in the flagstick.com shootout presented by Cobra Puma Golf, then you might want to get to flagstick.com or flagstickshootout.com. And get yourself registered. You won't have to pay for your entry at the time that you register, because just because you register does not mean that you're in the field. We'll start choosing pretty soon.
Yep.
First 10, just like we did last year, we'll have the first 10, we'll have the next 10, we'll have the next 10, and so on and so forth. As the applications come in, we'll choose to make sure that that we have the strongest field possible, the best people in the field possible. So it's not just about your index. We do kind of gauge what we know about the field. We want good players, but we want nice people and a strong field.
Yeah, obviously there's preference to people that have been involved with our tournaments 100%. And things before, lots of different things that way. And, you know, should mention, you know, the golf course at Smugglers Glen is already in great shape.
Oh my gosh.
I already heard from a few people, and so that's exciting that it's, you know, that it's gearing up already, that Jason and the crew have really been, you know, doing 100%. Good things already.
And my son Brandon and his friend Shane, who played in it last year, Brandon caddied for him. They played last week.
Okay.
At Smugglers. And
so they can confirm.
It was crispy. That's the
nice
discretion. I don't really understand the terminology of the teenagers these days, but I'm assuming that crispy means that it was in good shape and not, you know, crispy. Can't see how it possibly be my definition of crispy in April. So I'm assuming that means that it was good. They were raving about it, saying they could drive down to Smugglers and play every day and it wouldn't bother them. I'm like,
nice. Love it.
All right. Well, good. All right. Well, we're going to get out quickly here, take a break. And when we come back on the back nine, we're going to get a little bit more into the Masters, Augusta National, the skill that it takes to tackle a golf course like that, and how you can develop those skills on your own. So stick around. You're listening to the Flagstick podcast with Jeff Bonner and Scott McLeod, but we'll be right back.
When you golf on Prince Edward Island, there are over 400 fairways closer than you can imagine. Not to mention countless miles of pristine beaches and a rich world-class culinary experience. So get here fast, then take it slow and play around on Island Time. Golf Prince Edward Island.
Welcome back, friends, to the Flagstick Podcast. Yes, the Flagstick Podcast, where we have a lot of fun and we do some really strange, weird things sometimes, like the way that I'm talking right now when I'm introducing the back nine. The back nine, by the way, is presented by Celtic Golf Center, located only 20 minutes from Ottawa in Kempville. Celtic Golf Center's indoor golf at another level, featuring five state-of-the-art TrackMan simulators and two new Unicore sims. With GS Pro, Celtic Golf Center offers over 10,000 course options for you to play, including some major golf courses. So some with azaleas. I'll leave it at that. Play rounds with friends, practice full swing analysis, play golf games. Visit CelticGolfCenter.com to learn more, to book tee times. Okay. Now it is Masters Week. Preface once again, this is Thursday as we're recording, Friday when most people are probably tuning in for the first time. So there might be a round already completed by now, but we digress. It doesn't change what we have to talk about.
That's right.
So we thought maybe we'd get into the back nine a little bit instead of just being traditional. Let's talk about Masters. Let's talk about Augusta National. Let's talk specifically about the skills that it might take to tackle such a daunting beast that is Augusta National, and how you might develop those skills on your own.
Yeah. I'll tell you how this came about.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, so the if people follow,
I'll drink coffee.
Data Golf, which is the Korshin brothers, who obviously grew up in the Ottawa area playing junior golf, but have gone on to other things, and one of their things is, you know, data analytics regarding golf. And they had an article that really talked about the skills that it takes that's unusual regarding playing Augusta National and excelling at Augusta National. And, you know, maybe players that fit that mold a little bit better. And that sort of prompted a few different things that I was kind of looking at that, you know, maybe golfers, average golfers, everyday golfers sort of struggle a bit. And they're not going to be out there playing a 7,500 yard golf course, but relative to them, golf courses can certainly be, you know, long. And there's certain skills that maybe these players will need to win this week that are transferable, and people need to kind of maybe look at their own games and adapting to their own games. So that's sort of the origin in a short form.
Okay. Well, right off the bat, let's say that the average golfer will never or should never play a golf course from 7,500 yards.
Yeah.
But like you just said, relative to their own game, some courses feel like they play that way.
Yeah, they do, for sure.
First and foremost, long irons would be required more often than not.
Yeah, so if we look at that, again, from the Data Golf or whatever.
That's my sneeze button.
Yeah, good job with that.
Thanks.
They looked at, obviously, with the length of the golf course, it requires generally one to two more long irons than what they'd see, you know, kind of an average PGA Tour event. It just, you know, that's just the case. Got me thinking a lot about long irons and students and dealing with students you know, what goes into their bag. I mean, first off, you know, let's talk about even your golf bag. How has long irons changed for you over the years?
Well, they've changed for me, but I haven't really changed myself. Let's put it to you that way. So, as you know, having played golf with me for many, many years, probably the strongest part of my game, was my long iron game. which I developed because I didn't hit the ball particularly far as a younger amateur. Oddly enough, I probably hit it farther now. But I didn't hit it very long. So when I played golf, particularly with you and some other friends, they were generally longer than I was. We always played further back tees, probably tees that I probably shouldn't have been playing, but generally the company that I played with, I wanted to. I was a good enough golfer to play from further back, so I didn't worry too much about it. But the length of my game didn't really warrant playing 7,000-yard golf courses. So I would generally hit a lot of approach shots from 180, 190, 200, 210. And hybrids were not a thing back then.
Right.
So you either hit, had a driver, 3-wood and a 5-wood, because even 7-woods were just kind of entering into the scene. So, and then you had a 2-iron, 3-iron, 4-iron, 5-iron. So I just became very good at hitting long irons very accurately. I haven't changed that about my game. I have a hybrid, but I don't carry a 5-wood anymore. Right. So, so now I carry like a 4-hybrid, which is kind of like a 3-iron, 4-iron.
It has changed. And that was sort of my point.
But I still have a 4-iron in my bag
again
as well. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I still like on a par 3, I still feel that there's an accuracy thing about hitting an iron on a par 3. That is completely false, but
it's real in a way.
And mentally, I feel like I can hit an iron more accurately than I can hit. When I say accurately, I mean accurately from a distance perspective. I feel like a hybrid for me is when you talk about your clubs, they go, okay, I hit my 8-iron 150, I hit my 7-iron 160. Okay, there's 10 yards difference in there, but it's probably more like I hit my 8-iron 150 and I hit my 7-iron 155. When it comes to the hybrid, I might hit my 4-iron 200 yards, but I can hit that 4-hybrid anywhere from 190 to 220. Do you know what I mean? Like just the way, depending on the lie that I have, depending on the, like, because they go so much higher and they're a lot harder for me anyway, they're harder to flight. So they tend to kind of have this inaccuracy in distance, not so much inaccuracy in straight and like the dispersion, but inaccuracy in distance. Like I don't know if I take a full swing with it, if it's only going to go 200 or is it going to go 215.
You should always be thinking about dispersion though, in two different ways. It's north south and it's east west. So you're thinking about dispersion east west, but you know, again, you make a mention as far as a yardage with an iron specific thing. I will tell you that most golfers, you shouldn't be thinking about specific yardage. You should be thinking about a specific range of yardages because you're not that accurate. Not even the tour
players, I am, but that's okay.
Even the tour players won't think about it that way. But yeah, one of the evolutions that obviously has changed is people looking at the design. So first off, as we said, you know, if you're left with a lot of long irons, maybe you're playing off the wrong tee boxes, first off.
Oh yeah, 100%.
You know, but you know, and I'm not saying you, I'm just people in general. But again,
I do.
But people might want to play from those for specific reasons, social aspects and so forth. And, you know, they're playing with their friends, whatever the case may be. But really, when we start to look at, you know, fittings and how clubs are working, I will tell you this. I mean, long iron designs have gotten easier to play, easier to hit. You know, we've got, you know, thicker clubs with lower center of gravity, you know, back more, easier to launch. But in most cases, I would say, we still see, and I can tell you this personally, I'll see like college players that will show up and they still want to have a 2-iron in the bag and a 3-iron in the bag. But then the funny part was, you know, an hour later, be working with a guy who's a tour pro who's like, hey man, 3-iron's just no good for me in most situations. I need to look at a hybrid or a 7-wood or a 9-wood. So I find it funny that all of a sudden, you know, there's still some ego in there for that collegiate player or, you know, elite junior player or whatever the case may be. But the tour pro who realizes that that's maybe not the situation that they should be in. So the issue is that And this is why you're a decent iron player. You still swing with enough club head speed that you can launch your long irons. So you can get some separation between your clubs. Yeah. But generally, the average golfer is not swinging at enough speed that they're going to see the separation in the carry distance between their clubs. They might see the total overall distance, but that's not going to help them when they're hitting approaches into greens.
No.
And we should say that as part of that, if these things are launching too low, they don't become very effective as far as stopping. We're not getting an angle of descent where it's stopping as quickly as it should. And then it doesn't have that initial launch to be able to get that trajectory. And especially when you get in a situation that's a little bit more compromised, say rough or something like that. So first thing more than anything is just to address your equipment to really work with a fitter and go through and see what your actual carries are and see if there is a separation. And I can tell you last year I was doing yardage gapping with a Team Canada player, and she didn't have that much of a gap once she got to a certain long irons just because of speed. Mm-hmm. And that she needed more separation or to basically create either more loft on one club or less on another, or to put in a different design so that you get a separation. Otherwise, you basically have a useless piece of equipment that's in your bag that you're not getting something out of. So that is probably the first way to look at it, is to make sure that that's possible. And then secondly, as far as from a technique standpoint, players will generally, the biggest mistake that I see for most amateurs is that because it's a longer club and it's supposed to go further, they tend to put a lot more effort into making that swing, and they end up compromising some aspect of their swing, whether it's their sequence or whatever the case may be, instead of going, it's a longer club, it's got a longer shaft on it, it's got less loft on it, it's basically designed to deliver more ball speed, and you don't need to do anything different. So it's that kind of that patience level for players, and I know you do that well, which is why I use you as an example where you're not trying to sit there and force it with it, because you go from a 5-iron to a 4-iron. You don't sit there and go, oh, it's a 4-iron, I gotta swing this super hard. You're letting the club make the difference in that. So that would be the first thing I would say as far as that long irons and amateurs kind of addressing that in long
irons. Okay, so long irons. Now, sure. One of the things when we're talking about skills relative to skills required to play a golf course like Augusta National, I think it goes without saying, having watched enough Masters tournaments over the years and understanding what Augusta National really has from a standpoint of a protection mechanism, mm-hmm. is the necessity to be able to have a strong short game, especially mm-hmm. wedges, recovery wedges, pitches around greens and things like that, and also the ability to flight the ball a lot higher. Mm-hmm. The greens at Augusta National are not big and flat. No. There is a ton of slope. There are specific areas on the green that you want to land the ball. And this is what players will tell you, is that there may be a pin that's right there that looks like I can get there. I can get at that pin. But the reality is you don't want to get at that pin. You don't want to hit it 5-6 feet from the hole on the where the pin is. You want to hit it 20 feet to the right of where the pin is on a different area, because if you hit it there, the putt that you have from 6 feet is treacherous and almost impossible, but the putt that you have from 20 or 25 feet is makeable. And that's the one thing about Augusta National. You listen to from a course management, green management. So you need to be able to bring the ball in higher, mm-hmm. and you need to understand that you're going to miss greens mm-hmm. A lot. And you need to be able to have the game around the greens and from 30 yards out or 20 mm-hmm. yards out, being able to hit those short little pitch recovery shots. So that's another huge component to your game that you need to have to play Augusta.
Yeah, and you're doing it off of very tight lies, which is really a challenge for a lot of players, and most amateurs will struggle on those tight lies. If you take somebody who maybe hasn't played on an immaculate golf course before, and where you got a golf ball that's sort of propped up, and it's really easy to control the kind of the strike on the face, you get sort of the same strike all the time. It's like a ball on a tee, really, is what it amounts to. And then you put them on some really tight fairway, they generally don't have the same type of control that they would need. So what we really talk about there is dealing with those wedges is one, you know, having the creativity and imagination to look at multiple different types of shots. But a lot of them is that execution, is getting that strike so it's very similar each time, so they can control the outcomes, they can control the speed of the golf ball as far as the output off the club face. So really what we see when we see a lot of amateurs is I see a lot of short wedges all the time. You know, somebody will show up and they'll go, hey, I'm going to work on my wedges. I'm not really good with my wedges. And then you see a lot of people going, yeah, I'm going to try to get a lot of spin on this. And then you see them kind of mash the club head into the ground, thinking that somehow if this, you know, this major collision between club and earth is going to provide spin, when, you know, sometimes they forget that there's a golf ball in between there and they need to take care of that as far as the golf ball. So, so what we see a lot of times is players that are sort of, you know, driving the club down a little bit too long with their arms more than anything, and not allowing that club head to actually start to work its way up. And we're not talking about sculling the golf ball, but we're talking about getting the club head working on an arc height, or arc depth is how we call it, so that they can control the height of that club head and where the strike is on the face vertically, so that it can strike the golf ball cleanly, maybe slightly lower in the face. So it can, and we could get into that some other time, but talk about, you know, spin control and things like that. So basically for players that, you know, struggle on really tight chipping areas and so forth, they should be working a little bit less on kind of working the club down, and understand that, you know, good players. And if you go and watch some video of really good pitchers of the golf ball, you know, Victor Hovland's become one, a Luke Donald, Tiger Woods, what you're going to find is that they have a lot of what we'll call extension on their lead side of their body as they swing through, where you'll see that their upper body, and they start to rise up, even though the club head's still working down a little bit. And what it tends to do is it kind of keeps the club head a little bit more level with the golf ball, and the strike tends to be a little bit cleaner. So amateurs should feel like, not like they're trying to like jam down on it as much, just to realize that all the club is working down, they need to feel themselves working up a little bit more with their hands and really just brushing that grass with those swings. So taking some practice strokes where they're not really making as much of a divot. A drill that I do a lot with players just to kind of get them a feel, and you can use a alignment rod, you can use like a yardstick or whatever. Alignment rod's good because a lot of people have it, is just to put an alignment rod on the ground, kind of where you're going to, you know, kind of make your stroke. And what you want to do is just kind of work on just catching the alignment rod so that it doesn't really move the alignment rod, so that you can just basically tick it so the club's coming in nice and shallow. And then basically you're just kind of, as I said, just brushing it like you would the grass, rather than the club crashing into the alignment rod and making it bounce. Especially we see that, you know, working indoors, you see it kind of bounce off the artificial turf.
Yeah.
And just working on that arc height. And what they'll find is that they'll have cleaner contact when they're outside. It's a more consistent strike. The spin will be more consistent. And as a result of it, those type of things, the outcomes will be more predictable, which is really what you need, as opposed to all of a sudden one swing works out well and then the next takes off and just kind of gets you in trouble. And those are skills that tour players have, things that they work on all the time, and that amateurs need to spend more time on.
Okay. And the last thing that we'll touch on with respect to skills required to play a golf course like Augusta National would be the most obvious one, and that is putts.
Yeah.
Particularly reading long, fast putts. Amateurs tend to under-read putts.
By a lot.
And try higher lines instead of trying to jam putts, capture the speed. So let's talk about that just from an instruction perspective, from your perspective. you know, how does that look with respect?
Yeah, well, that's
to
that's what we want them to try to do. Is we want them to try higher lines, yes, instead of trying to jam those putts. You have to realize that even though it's a longer putt, we still have a capture speed. Basically, it's a speed that the ball is rolling at that you can make use of the hole as much as possible. And I'll find that in most times, and you know, I'm fortunate to have access to some really good putting coaches. And John Graham, who's down in Rochester, went down to see him, I don't know, probably 10 years ago. And he was the guy I first learned some aim point stuff from. And we looked at and talked about amateurs and under-reedy putts. And he has worked with some of the best players in the world, be it a Danny Willett, a Masters champion, a Justin Thomas, Cameron Champ. There's tons of players. And he would find that one of the first things he does is he gets people to kind of look at a putt. And he's got this long rope, and he basically says, you know, lay out the line that you would use. And in most cases, almost every single person underreads where they're going to put the putt. So as a result of it, they end up having to hit the ball too hard in order to get the ball in online, and they end up rolling it too far past the hole. And that's where people get in trouble. I mean, most amateurs get themselves in trouble, not because of lines in a lot of cases. It's more about that. It's that speed control for sure, because they're too aggressive with it. So, what I like players to do a lot is really to play around with getting used to the concept of using more break and realizing you have more opportunities for the ball to be going towards the hole rather than once it starts to go away from the hole. Mm-hmm. If it's too low, it's not going in. As obvious as that sounds, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But see players consistently hitting those first putts and, you know, immediately right off the hop, they have no chance of going in the hole because, you know, if they're going to go in the hole on those lines, it's going so fast that you would have to hit the, you know, the exact middle of the hole. Anything that's on the edge is going to go off. So I'd say the really big way to get used to that more than anything is to find a big breaking putt. So find a, you know, a 15, 20 foot putt or whatever on a practice green or whatever. And you want to work on what speed can I get and what's the maximum amount of break that I can use to get the ball to the hole. Understanding that there's multiple lines, mm-hmm, that you can use to get the ball towards the hole. It's not a defined, it's actually a corridor more than anything. It's not one line that's, oh, that's the perfect line. You know, that's a perfect line at that speed, but you still have some variance, but you have more variance if you're using a wider kind of apex point to go around. So what I'll do is I'll get players sometimes, and every amateur can do this, is basically find a breaking putt. So let's say it's a right to left putt. Put a tee down where, as far as an aim point, but put it very high as far as where the break is going to be, and hit a putt towards it, see where it falls, and then progressively take the tee and move it higher and higher and see what's the maximum break that you can take with matching with whatever speed that gets the golf ball to the hole and stopping. And you'd be quite surprised in most times how wide of a path that you can take with a breaking putt and get it back to the hole and have that opportunity to take full advantage of the width of the hole as far as that speed is concerned. So, you know, that takes a lot of patience. It takes some trust. And we just get scared because we think that, you know, if we're aiming away from the hole, it doesn't have a chance to go in. Yeah. But I guarantee you the ones where you're trying to take the direct line, especially you see that in the scrambles, you know, the guy, the fourth guy, I'm just going to jam this in. Well, guess what? It's no different on the fourth putt than the first putt. Trying to hit it harder and faster on the fourth putt is not helping. It's actually hurting you more than anything. So that's a skill that, you know, a lot of golfers can work on, especially this time of year, you know, to start out the year to get a feel for their speed.
All right. Now, one of the things that just as we close out this sort of segment here, one of the things that that was sort of brought to light this week, Rory was doing some talking about how Augusta National has a tendency to tease you into making mistakes.
Yeah,
you know, where it's just the type of golf course that it tricks your mind into believing that as good as you are and have the number of shots that you have in your bag and your ability to play. And he said he considers himself, you know, he considers himself a pretty good golfer and has, and pretty much feels like he can hit any shot he wants to hit at any time. But at Augusta National, that is not something that you should engage in. That sometimes taking the path of least resistance and dialing it back a little bit and not taking that risk is the smarter choice, even though you can hit that shot.
Right.
You know, and maybe a good example of that back in the day was Phil Mickelson hitting a shot. I think he was up on the top 13. Of 13,
13 the pine
in the
straw.
Pine Straw. And, yeah. And I think that Bones did not want him to attempt that shot. He didn't feel that was a high percentage shot. And Mickelson, you know, basically told him to sit down and let me hit the shot. You're the caddy kind of thing. And he hit the shot and the shot pulled off the shot barely pulled off the shot. And obviously, you know, I think went on to make a birdie or whatever the case may be there. And it turned out great, but the percentage, that was a low
yeah.
Percentage play to make.
But from one of the most highly skilled players in the world. So
he
not
knew his capability, but the chances of him sitting down, putting another ball where he just hit from and pulling that shot off a second time, he probably hits it in the water.
Yeah.
Or he hits it fat and it dribbles down to the bottom of the hill. So that's what Rory's talking about is patience with, you know, with the golf. It's 72 holes.
Right. Yeah.
Unless that is I need to make birdie to have a shot to win.
Mm-hmm.
Not making birdie here means I lose.
That's a whole different.
And frankly, when you're, that's a little early in the back nine to be taking that kind of a risk. Like if that's the 17th hole or the 18th hole and you're down by two.
Yep.
And your mindset is forget the paycheck. I want to win. Well, then you go for that shot because the worst case scenario is you finish, you lose a shot and you end up not winning. Well, if you don't take that risk, maybe you don't have a shot at the eagle that could win you the tournament. But playing that early in the round, and I can't even remember 100%, but I think that was a pretty high risk shot to play given where he was in the tournament at the time too. So
yeah, when we talk about players and how that, you know, those players, now we, you know, transfer that over to the amateur who does not have the skill or the capability to pull off those shots, but might have the confidence that, hey, let's try to do that. But the odds are slim on that. And, you know, if we start to look at amateurs, even a good amateur, and we look at their scorecard, they score well, generally, not because they make more birdies. It's because they more avoid more bogeys or double bogeys and making those big numbers. And while it's fun, and certainly I'm not saying, you know, in your casual rounds and stuff like that, where you don't really care, you know, trying a shot is fine. Sure. But if you care about your score, you won't do that. Yeah. So especially this time of year, if your game is not really kind of up to snuff yet, it's avoiding those big disasters and moving those off the cards. I mean, I know one of the things that I monitor more times than not, especially junior players, college players and so forth, and looking at their scorecards, I cringe immediately when I look and see a huge number on their, and that's when I begin. That's the first thing I always ask about, how that happened. Yeah, and there could be valid reasons. There could be weird things that happen that cause of it. But if it's because of a decision rather than a shot, that's a real mistake, because you don't have to have skill to make a decision, right? You just have to be able to have the patience to not try something that you're not capable of, take the easier option. And you know what? If you can avoid those disasters, you generally will have a much cleaner card. And by the time you're done, because it affects your emotions as well. And if you all of a sudden make a triple bogey on a hole and you feel, you know, anger or whatever, it's going to start affecting other shots. It may affect you mentally thinking about that later on in the round, all sorts of different things. So I would just say for the amateurs, develop some patience, develop a strategy, get yourself out of trouble. Don't buy yourself more trouble and you'll be better off.
I've always played myself with the philosophy that double is bad, bogey is fine. I can always rebound from a bogey.
Right.
Bogey is one birdie.
Right.
A double is two. And when you're a six handicap,
you're not making that
You're not making four or five birdies in a round. So you can't afford the doubles. So, but you can afford the bogeys. I mean, think about it. You can make seven bogeys in a round of golf and shoot 79. That's a respectable score.
Sure.
And to think that you're not going to make any birdies, it's probably a pretty high percentage you'll make one or two.
Yeah.
Depending on your index.
Yeah.
But if you're making one or two birdies and you're making six bogeys, seven bogeys, eight bogeys, that's okay. I mean, that's generally, that's my typical round of golf when I'm, when I'm not in massive amounts of joint pain. My typical round of golf is I'll make two, maybe three birdies in a round, but usually two, and I'll make seven or eight bogeys. And, and I generally don't make very many doubles. And when I do make doubles, that's usually when I shoot in the 80s, because you just can't come back from that. I just don't have a six birdie. I don't have six birdies in my arsenal. Yeah. I can't afford to make the big number. So, and most amateurs, if you want to keep your scores down, like Scott said, you have to avoid the big mistakes, which means you have to pitch out instead of trying to hit it through the trees. You have to make sure you don't go for the green in two if there's water in front of it, because you're bringing the big number into play. If a par four is a longer par four, play it for three shots instead of trying to hit it on in two. Maybe just playing it like it's a par five and taking your bogey and running is not a bad thing. But
no, because you can
it
still
as
make,
a par five,
you still make your you can still make your four. You can get that up and down,
but you won't make a double. And that's the to me that's the key.
Yeah,
no doubles.
Yeah, for sure.
All that's right, so we've given you a lot of insight. If you ever have the opportunity to play Augusta National, then now you have all the knowledge to work on your game going into it, knowing what you need to have for the skills required to play Augusta National, if that ever comes to light for you. And if it does, I am only a phone call away or an email if you're looking for a fourth. All right. Well, that's it for us for this this episode of the Flagstick Podcast. It's Masters Week. Please, everybody, enjoy the Masters. Enjoy the first major of the year. It can't be a bad one. It never can. Enjoy the weekend. I know I will. Scott, thanks for this. And thanks to all our sponsors, Metcalf Golf Club, Celtic Golf Center. Our presenting sponsor, of course, Golf PEI. Golf Prince Edward Island is a premier Canadian destination, boasting most number of golf courses per capita in our wonderful country, with over 400 fairways closer than you think. Top-tier accommodations and exquisite culinary experiences. It is the easiest golf vacation you will ever book. Visit golfpei.ca to book those vacations and tee times. Well, I certainly hope that you're enjoying, listening to us and watching if you so desire on YouTube. Be sure to follow us across all social media networks, including Instagram, X, and Facebook. Subscribe on Spotify, Audible, and Apple Podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel. Like us and click the notification bell. Make sure that you never miss a single episode or miss anything that we post on YouTube. Get over to flagstick.com for more amazing golf content delivered to you every single day. And make sure that you subscribe to Flagstick Digest to make sure that we push all that information directly to you three times a week. As always, we do appreciate you tuning in. But until next week, I'm Jeff Bonner.
I'm Scott McLeod.
Remember, always go for the stick.